he was streets ahead of everyone. We told England we were sure David would be fit in time. The obsession with David's recovery was predictable. An oxygen tent found its way to Carrington. We had good results from that device and Roy Keane's hamstring injury before a European game. Bones are a different matter. The cure is rest. It's time. A metatarsal is a 6 to 7 week injury. In the 2002 World Cup, England failed to make much of an impact. Against Brazil, they were outplayed by 10 men. In the first group game, they played long ball against Sweden, who knew the English game, and so were hardly likely to be caught off guard by direct play. It's an indictment of English teams at youth level that so many have fallen back on this outdated tactic. Too many played long ball. On one occasion, we made a point of monitoring Tom Cleverley in the under-21s against Greece, and our scouts reported that England played one up with two wide, Cleverley being one of the wide players, and Tom didn't get a kick. Chris Smalling played and kept launching the ball forward. This is the area where England were always likely to be caught out, because they don't have enough technical and coaching ability. The years from 9 to 16 are thrown away. So how do they compensate? The boys compete physically. Great attitude they have, sleeves up, but they don't produce a player. They are never going to win a World Cup with that system, that mentality. Brazil would produce young players who could take the ball in any position, at any angle. They are fluid in their movements. They are football-minded people because they are accustomed to it from 5 or 6 years of age. David worked extremely hard on the technical side of his game. He was also a wonderful networker. Even when he was left out of the GB Olympic squad in the summer of 2012, it was his camp that released the news rather than the FA. The quotes were all magnanimous, but I'm sure he was as sick as a pig. I remember Mel Machin saying to me, "Giggs and Beckham, the world-class players, and you get them to go from box to box as well. How do you do that?" I could only reply that they were gifted not only with natural talent, but the stamina to carry them up and down the pitch. We had something special with those two. It changed with David, because he wanted it to change. His eye was off the ball. A shame, because he could still have been at Manchester United when I left. He would have been one of the greatest Man United legends. The only thing making him a legend at LA Galaxy and beyond was his iconic status. At some point in his life, he may feel the urge to say, "I made a mistake." But let me also pay tribute to him. His powers of perseverance are amazing, as he showed when joining Paris Saint-Germain in January 2013. At United, he was always the fittest boy in the building. That helped him carry on playing to the age of 37. The stamina he built into himself from childhood survived. The MLS is not a Mickey Mouse league. It's actually quite an athletic league. I watched Beckham in the final of the MLS Cup and noticed how well he did, tracking back, putting in a shift. Nor did he disgrace himself at Milan during his loan period there. At PSG, he played for an hour in the quarter-finals of the European Cup. He wasn't in the game much, but he carried out his duties well. He worked hard and hit a few good passes early in the game. I asked myself, how does he do it? Stamina was the first answer. But David also discovered a desire to confound everybody. And he could still hit a fine cross, a good crossfield ball, which are traits he never lost. They were ingrained in what he was as an athlete. To play in the latter round of the Champions League at nearly 38 was quite an achievement after 5 years in America. He was back in the mix. You can only praise him for that. One or two people asked me whether I would take him back after he left LA. With him at 37, there was no point going down that road. There was a publicity element for PSG in signing him in a 6-month deal. David, however, ignored that part of it. As far as he was concerned, he was still a great player. Giggs, Scholes and I discussed this one day. As I said, he had this talent for blocking out bad performances. I would give him stick and he would go off in a huff, probably thinking, "That manager's off his head. I was good today." In LA, he probably thought Hollywood was his next step in life. There was a purpose and a plan in him going to Los Angeles, I think. That aside, you have to admire his tenacity. He amazed me, and he amazed everyone at Manchester United. Whatever he pursues in life, he just keeps on going. 6. Rio. Rio Ferdinand's 8-month suspension was a shock that reverberated to the core of Manchester United, and my indignation endures to this day. My issue is not with the rules on dope testing, but with how the process unfolded on the day Rio was meant to provide a routine sample at our training ground. On the 23rd of September 2003, a drug testing team from UK Sport arrived at Carrington to take random samples from 4 of our players, whose names were picked out of a hat. What started as a routine training day was to have huge ramifications for Rio, his family, Manchester United and England. Rio, who was one of those selected, left Carrington without providing a sample, and by the time we managed to get hold of him, the drug testers had left for the day. He took the test the following day, the 24th of September, but was told he was in breach of the strict liability rule on dope tests and would be charged. The outcome was that Rio was banned from the 20th of January to the 2nd of September 2004 and fined £50,000. Aside from all the Man United games he missed, it also meant he was ineligible for the 2004 European Championship in Portugal. His removal by the FA from the England squad to play Turkey in October 2003 almost caused a strike by the England players. On the fateful morning in September, the testers were having a cup of tea and, in my judgment, didn't do their job. They didn't go looking for Rio. My view of it is that the testers should go onto the pitch and stand there until the player finishes training, then follow him to the dressing room. Round about that time, testers went to Wrexham Football Club and ended up testing my son Darren and 2 other players. They stayed on the pitch, escorted them to the changing area and extracted the necessary urine sample. Why did that not happen with Rio at Carrington? We knew the testers were at our training centre because Mike Stone, the doctor, told us the drug people were on the premises. Mike had a cup of tea with them while the message was sent down to the affected players in the dressing room. Rio was given the message, no doubt about that. But if you think of Rio's laid-back nature, it was no surprise that he failed to hook up with people who were nowhere to be seen. He was not a drug taker. Rio Ferdinand was not a drug taker. We would have known. It shows in their eyes, and he never missed a training session. Drug takers are all over the place. They become inconsistent. Rio would never have been a drug taker because his sense of responsibility as to who he is in sport is too big. Rio is an intelligent guy, but easygoing. He made a mistake, but so did the drug people. They didn't take the steps that would have averted the crisis that ensued. They should have been on that training field, waiting to take him in for his test. I was aware that a serious breach of the drug testing rules had been committed, but I still found it hard to believe that Rio would end up with such a brutal punishment. The tendency is to treat players the way you would your children, and not believe them to be guilty of any allegation that originated outside the family. Maurice Watkins, our solicitor, was quite confident we could win our case on the grounds that the officials had not physically taken Rio away for the test. In my opinion, an example was often made of Manchester United. Eric Cantona was the first major case when in 1995 he was sentenced to 2 weeks imprisonment and banned from playing for 9 months for his kung fu kick at a spectator. His prison sentence was later commuted to 120 hours community service. Then in 2008, Patrice Evra was disciplined by the FA after a confrontation with a groundsman at Stamford Bridge. Patrice picked up a 4-match ban for a skirmish in the pitch, when everyone had gone home with a groundsman. People assumed Man United received special treatment. The reverse was often true. After a lot of legal to-ing and fro-ing, Rio's hearing was held by an FA disciplinary commission at Bolton's Reebok Stadium in December 2003 and lasted 18 hours. It was 86 days after the missed test. I was among those who gave evidence on Rio's behalf. But the 3-man panel found Rio guilty of misconduct. Maurice Watkins called the sentence savage and unprecedented, and David Gill said Rio had been made a scapegoat. Gordon Taylor of the PFA called it draconian. I spoke to Rio's mother right away because the poor woman was in bits. We could feel devastated by the loss of an important player, but it is the mother who will carry the real weight of such a punishment. Janice was crying down the phone as I told her that our high opinion of Rio would not be affected by the events of the last 4 months. We knew he was innocent. We knew he had been careless, and we knew he had been punished too severely. At that stage we were considering an appeal, but it was obvious we had no chance of winning. I could never understand that a missed drug test was treated as seriously as a failed one. If you admit to being a drug taker, you're rehabilitated. We felt that the player was telling the truth, whereas the system assumed he was not. Nor did we like the fact that information seemed to be leaking to the press from the FA. In our view, the confidentiality principle was being breached. I told the hearing at Bolton that Rio would be in my team to play Spurs that weekend, regardless of the outcome. He played alongside Mikhail Silvestre in a 2-1 win at White Hart Lane. In his last game for 8 months, Rio started in our 1-0 defeat at Wolves on the 17th of January 2004, but came off injured after 50 minutes. Wes Brown took his place. Kenny Miller scored the only goal of the game. I felt stricken to have lost him for so long. Our relationship started, in a sense, long before I made him the most expensive signing in English football. I was very friendly with Mel Machin, who called me from Bournemouth in 1997 to say he had a boy on loan from West Ham. "Go and buy him," Mel said. "What's his name?" "Rio Ferdinand." I knew that name from England youth teams. Mel was insistent. Mel, of course, was close to Harry Redknapp, then manager of West Ham, where Rio had been nurtured, so I was sure his judgment was based on solid information. I raised the subject of this young Bournemouth loanee with Martin Edwards. He had him watched at Bournemouth and made a note of his attributes. Graceful, balanced, first touch like a centre-forward. Then we checked his background. Martin called the West Ham chairman, Terry Brown, who said, "Give us a million plus David Beckham." In other words, he's not for sale. At that time, Jaap Stam and Ronnie Johnson were ensconced in the heart of our defence, and Wes Brown was emerging as a young centre-half of promise. In the event, Rio was transferred to Leeds for £18 million. In his first game for our Yorkshire rivals, he played in a back three against Leicester City and was annihilated. Watching that match, I felt a surge of relief, which I laugh about now. Thank God we didn't buy him. He was all over the place. But, needless to say, he developed exceptionally well. Centre-backs were the foundation of my Manchester United sides. Always centre-backs. I looked for stability and consistency. Take Steve Bruce and Gary Pallister. Until I found those two, we were without a prayer. Paul McGrath was constantly injured. Kevin Moran always had split heads. He was like a punch-drunk boxer by the time I became his manager. I went to a game in Norway where Ron Yates was present in his capacity as chief scout for Liverpool. "I saw your old player at Blackburn last week, Kevin Moran," said Ron over a drink. I asked, "How did he do?" Answer, "It lasted about 15 minutes, got taken off with a split heed." "Not unusual, that," I said. Graham Hogg, meanwhile, had not reached the standard we required, so I always told my chairman. "We need centre-backs who will play every week. They give you the steadiness and consistency and continuity." That led us to Bruce and Pallister, who played forever and never seemed to be injured. I remember one Friday before we played Liverpool, Bruce hobbling around the cliff, rubbing his hamstring and saying, "Don't pick your team yet." He had injured it the previous weekend. I liked to set out my team on the Friday so we could practice set pieces and so on. "What are you on about?" I said. "I'll be all right," says Steve. "Don't be so stupid," I say. So he starts running around the cliff. He jogs round the pitch twice. "I'm all right," he says. He's only facing Ian Rush and John Aldridge for Liverpool. Meanwhile, he can't stop rubbing his hamstring. Bruce played right through that game. He and Pally were marvellous. Stam brought us the same toughness and reliability. Look, too, at the partnership between Ferdinand and Vidic. Brilliant. Solid, nothing given away. Consider Manchester United teams from that whole era, and the centre-backs were always a feature. So buying Ferdinand in July 2002 conformed to my sacred team-building policy of strength in the middle. We paid a lot, but when you spread that kind of transfer fee for a centre-half over 10 or 12 years, it starts to look like a bargain. You can fritter away plenty of money on contenders who simply aren't good enough. Better to spend more on a single player of unquestionable class. We paid £3.75 million for Roy Keane, which was a transfer record at the time.
But we had 12 years out of Roy.
In my time at United, I sold a lot of players people might not be familiar with. Young reserve players and so on. On a cruise round the west of Scotland at the end of my last season, I worked out that I had spent an average of less than £5 million a season over my time at Man United. I told Rio straight away when he joined. "You're a big casual sod." He said, "I can't help it." "Well, you'll need to help it, because it'll cost you goals. And I'll be on your back," I said. And he was casual. Sometimes he would glide along in second or third gear, and then take off like a sports car. I had never seen a big lad of 6'2" possess such an impressive change of pace. With time, his concentration improved and the expectations he placed on himself rose, along with the degree of responsibility he was willing to take on in the team and around the club. He became the complete footballer. When you acquire a young player, you don't get the complete package on purchase day. There's work to be done. If Rio was going to switch off in a game, it would be against one of the lesser teams that he didn't regard as a major threat. The bigger the game, the more he liked it. With Gary Neville beginning to pick up injuries and Vidic and Evra settling in, Rio and Edwin van der Sar became the defensive fulcrum of the team in the second half of that decade. I played Rio once in the centre of midfield in 2006 against Blackburn Rovers, and he got himself sent off. Robbie Savage was the victim of the tackle that put Rio back in the changing room. This may surprise some, but Pallister was as good a footballer as Rio. Oddly, he was quicker too, but he was no fan of running. Pally was anti-work, and I say that affectionately. He used to say that the less he did, the better he felt. He was the world's worst trainer. I was always after him. In the first 15 minutes, he would stagger out of a penalty area after an opposition attack, gasping for air. I would say to Brian Kidd, "Look at that, Pally, he's dying." I confess, I used to slaughter him. Picking him up one night for a club dinner, I entered his house to find a giant bottle of Coca-Cola on his fireside table and a big bag of sweets, crunchies, Rolos, Mars bars. I said to Mary, his wife, "What about this?" "I don't know how many times I tell him, boss. He doesn't listen," Mary said. So we hear footsteps on the stairs, and Pally descends to see me studying this vast stash of kiddie food. Why'd you buy all that stuff, Mary?" he says to his wife. So I fire back, "You big lazy so-and-so. I'm fining you for that." Gary was no Adonis, but he was a seriously good player with a sweet nature. A lovely lad. Like Rio, he could pass a ball and was quick when he wanted to be. In his last season with us, he sustained a cut in his eyebrow and was howling, complaining that it was the first time he'd been cut in his life. It didn't go with his image. Pally thought he was Cary Grant. I wasn't consciously looking for a centre-back who could carry the ball out of defence or send an incisive pass like Franz Beckenbauer. Pace and the ability to read the game are non-negotiables at the top in modern football. Rio had both, which is why I signed him. Not only could he defend, but he could bring the ball out. So although defending came first with me, it was encouraging to know my new centre-back could also start moves from the back, which became the norm later with Barcelona and others. At points in Rio's career, it was fair to say that his life expanded in more directions than we were happy with. I told him I was fed up with reading about him at dinners and launches. "You know the thing about football? It catches you. What happens in the football field tells everybody," I told him. "When you start to decline, it happens quickly. At a small club, you can get away with it. But at Manchester United, there were 76,000 pairs of eyes on us, and you could never kid them." I told Rio that if any of these distractions reduced his effectiveness as a footballer, he would not be with us much longer, because I would not be picking him. But he responded well to those warnings. We devised a system in which his agent was obliged to tell us everything he was doing, which gave us greater control. There was a music company, a film, a TV production company, and a magazine that took him to America to interview P. Diddy. "Give me a break, Rio," I said when I heard he was going to meet that star of the American rap scene. "Is he going to make you a better centre-half?" Rio was not alone in exploring other outlets. It all stemmed from the celebrity status of the modern footballer. Some looked to expand it. Beckham was one, and Rio became another. David's success in that respect was miraculous. Not all Rio's outside work was celebrity-driven. His work for UNICEF in Africa was terrific. You can never dismiss the impact a Rio Ferdinand could make on the life of a black child in Africa. Our message was simply that he had to balance fame with a need to remember what made him successful in the first place. Some won't do that. Some can't. We also thought Rio was always preparing for his life after football, which was not unreasonable. I did much the same by taking my coaching badges. That took me 4 years. So I also prepared for the second half of my life after playing, but not by meeting P. Diddy. There is that moment when a player asks himself what he is going to do, because stopping is such a void. 1 minute you're playing in European finals, FA Cup finals, winning championships, then it all fades to nothing. How to cope with that is a challenge all footballers face. Fame offers no immunity from the emotional come down. The second half is not as exciting. So how do you recreate it? How do you replace the thrill of sitting in that dressing room 10 minutes before the kick-off of a game that is going to determine who wins the league? By the end of my time, Rio had developed back problems. We picked out the goal we conceded to City's Craig Bellamy in the Manchester Derby of 2009 as an example of him working under a physical handicap. 2 years previously, he would have taken the ball off Bellamy and thrown him aside. Another was the Fernando Torres goal at Liverpool, when Torres beat him for speed and leaned on him one-on-one in the penalty box in front of the Kop. We analysed that with him in a DVD review. Rio stepped up to play Torres offside, and a year previously would have recovered from that error to dispossess him. But in this instance, he was fighting to get back to deal with the threat, and Torres shouldered him out of the road and blasted it into the net. Nobody did that to Rio. It told you the back injury was not only causing him pain, but also adversely affecting his balance. Rio always cruised. He never had to fight to run. After the long layoff that caused him to miss most of the winter, he came back brilliantly in training and excelled against City in the semi-final second leg in 2010 at Old Trafford after almost 3 months out. In his autumn years, I had to tell him to change his game, to take account of age and what it does to all of us. The years catch up with you. I told him, publicly and privately, that he needed to step back a yard or two to give himself a chance against strikers. 5 years previously, it had been lollipop stuff. With his change of pace, he'd rob a centre-forward just when the striker thought he was in business. He could no longer do that. He needed to be on the scene before the crime could happen. He was fine with my analysis. He wasn't insulted. It was simply explaining the changes in his body. And he had a great season in 2011-2012, marred only, for him, by his omission from the England Euro 2012 squad. When Roy Hodgson asked my opinion about whether Rio could work with John Terry, I replied, "Ask him. Ask Rio about their relationship," because I couldn't really give him an answer. Another minor incident with him was when he refused to wear a Kick It Out t-shirt in 2012-2013, after I thought we had all agreed to publicly back the campaign. It was a lack of communication. When he decided to boycott the Kick It Out t-shirt, Rio should have come to me, because he knew it was on the cards for all of us to wear them. I know he had an issue over Anton, his brother, and John Terry, but I didn't anticipate it spilling over in that way. Terry, of course, was punished by the FA for using racially abusive language against Anton in a game between QPR and Chelsea at Loftus Road. I was in my office when Mark Halsey came in to tell me Rio was not wearing the Kick It Out jersey. I found Albert, our kit man, and instructed him to tell Rio to put the garment on. The word came back that Rio would not be putting it on. When I confronted him, he said nothing, but after the game came in to explain that he felt the PFA were not doing enough to fight racism. My position was that by not wearing the t-shirt, he wasn't supporting the anti-racism cause. If he had a problem with the PFA, he should, I felt, take that up with them. I thought it was divisive not to wear the t-shirt. My view on racism is that I really don't comprehend how anyone could hate anyone else on the basis of their colour. 7. Lean times. A wind of change was coming, but it was not here yet. From the summer of 2003 to May 2006 was one of my least fertile spells. We won the FA Cup in 2004 and the League Cup 2 years later, but Arsenal and Chelsea were the league's title-winning outfits in that period. Before Cristiano Ronaldo and Wayne Rooney could become the core of our 2008 Champions League winning side, there was a rocky road when we attempted to implant experienced players, many of whom failed to make the expected impact. David Beckham had left for Real Madrid and Veron was to leave for Chelsea. Barthez was replaced in goal by Tim Howard and Cliberson. Eric Jemba Jemba and David Bellion were among the new faces. Ronaldinho might have been too, had he not said yes, then no to our offer. You can't dodge the truth about those years. We rushed down the path of buying in proven players who we thought would match our standards right away. Cliberson, for example, was a World Cup winner with Brazil and was only 24. Veron was an established player with a worldwide reputation. Jemba Jemba had been playing at a decent level in France. They were easy or obvious signings, a fact that worried me. I don't like easy signings. I like having to fight for a player on the grounds that a battle to extricate him means you're acquiring something valuable. I liked it when the selling club were desperate to hang on to their man. But the players we bought around then were easy to recruit. It felt as if we were signing every goalkeeper in the country. Mark Bosnich was a prime example. The Bosnich buy stemmed from Peter Schmeichel announcing in the autumn of his final season that he would be retiring, which caught us in the hop. We jumped into decisions. We met Bosnich in January, despite reports filtering through to us about his conduct off the pitch. I sent someone down to watch him in training. He was doing nothing in the sessions that convinced me he was the right man for Manchester United. So I changed tack and went for Edwin van der Sar instead. Spoke to his agent and then to Martin Edwards, who told me, "Alex, I'm sorry, I've shaken hands with Bosnich." That was a blow. Martin had shaken Mark's hand and would not go back on his word, which I respect. But it was a bad piece of business. Bosnich was a problem. His training and fitness levels were below what we needed. We pushed him to a higher tier and felt we did quite well with him. He was terrific in our victory over Palmeiras in the Intercontinental Cup, in which he ought to have been man of the match ahead of Giggs. Not much later, we played down at Wimbledon in February, and Bosnich was tucking into everything. Sandwiches, soups, steaks. He was going through the menu, eating like a horse. I told him, "For Christ's sake, Mark, we've got the weight off you. Why are you tucking into all that stuff?" "I'm starving, gaffer," he said. We arrived back in Manchester, and Mark was on a mobile phone to a Chinese restaurant to order a takeaway. "Is there no end to you?" I asked him. "Think what you're doing." I just couldn't make an impact on him. You don't recover easily from losing a Peter Schmeichel. He was the best goalkeeper in the world, and his presence, his personality, were suddenly no longer there. We should have replaced him with van der Sar. His agent had told me, "You'll need to be busy, because he's talking to Juventus." But we missed the boat. I had to return to Edwin's agent and tell him we had already agreed to take someone else, and that I would have to withdraw my interest. I should have taken him as well, as a second purchase. We'd soon have found out about Bosnich, and Edwin would have played from the end of the Schmeichel era pretty much to my last years in charge. I wouldn't have needed to spend money on Massimo Taibbi, or Barthez, who was a good goalkeeper, but had problems back in France. Later we saw that van der Sar's qualities were in the same league as those of Schmeichel. There was little between them, talent-wise. Schmeichel pulled off saves he wasn't entitled to make. There were moments of wonder. "Jesus, how did he do that?" I would ask. He had such a spring, such athleticism. With van der Sar, I would point to his composure, his calmness, his use of the ball, his organisational ability. It was a different style of goalkeeping, but still invaluable. It affected people around him in a good way. Schmeichel, by contrast, had a love-hate relationship with Steve Bruce and Gary Pallister. He would come out screaming and bawling at them, and Brucey would say, "Get back in your goal, you big German tart." Schmeichel hated that. "I'm not German," he would hiss. They were great buddies off the field, though. On it, Schmeichel was a volatile individual. In the dressing room, Van der Sar was very emphatic about performances. He had a strong voice, a Dutch voice. "No messing about out here," he would bark. Schmeichel would impose his voice on the team as well. I was lucky to have the two best goalkeepers of those three decades. An honourable mention would have to go to Peter Shilton and to Gianluigi Buffon. But to me, Schmeichel and Van der Sar were the best from 1990 to 2010. There is more to the art than the goalkeeping. It is a question of the personality you bring to the job. Not only do keepers have to deal with the business of making saves, they must cope with the process of making errors. You need a big character at Manchester United to handle the aftermath of a high-profile mistake. I had scouted Schmeichel half a dozen times. Alan Hodgkinson, the goalkeeping coach, had told me, "He's a certainty. Take him." At first, I was ambivalent about bringing foreign goalkeepers into the English game. One of Schmeichel's early games was against Wimbledon. The crazy gang were blitzing him, dropping bombs on top of him and elbowing him. Schmeichel was going crazy, shouting for the officials to help him. "Referee! Referee!" I watched this scene unfold and thought, "He's got no chance." The ref couldn't get back up the pitch and away from the conflict zone quickly enough. In another of his early matches, Peter came out for a cross at the back post and missed it by about 2 days. Lee Chapman knocked it in. So he did make mistakes while he was adjusting to the game in this country, and people were saying, "What have we got here?" But he also had an incredible physique. He covered the goal and he was brave. His distribution of the ball was marvellous. All those qualities came to his assistance in those torrid early days. Van der Sar oversaw a lot of change in our defence. Schmeichel stood behind the same back four just about every week. Parker, Bruce, Pallister, Irwin. They played virtually every game. Van der Sar had to get used to different centre-backs, new full-backs. There was flux. In those circumstances, it's a great credit to him that he was able to organise that part of the team so well. This was a time when Peter Kenyon was our chief executive in charge of transfer dealings. Arsenal's Patrick Vieira was one we liked a lot. I asked Peter to phone Arsenal to inquire about Vieira. He told me he had. One day later, I mentioned it to David Dean, and he looked at me as if I had horns on my head. There was no recognition of what I was talking about. One of them was playing his cards close to his chest, and, to this day, I have no idea which one it was. Time and again, I had agents phoning me to say, "My man would love to play for Manchester United." I never doubted the claim, but I also knew they would have loved to play for Arsenal, Real Madrid, Bayern Munich, and all the other elite teams. Players obviously like to get to the big clubs. The agent gets more out of it too. It was in that phase of playing the market that we fixed our gaze on Veron. The team was altering. It's not an easy thing for a manager to see change coming from a long way down the road. The old back four broke up fastest. When these sudden changes strike, you realise you don't necessarily have the backup. Later, I made it my policy to plan much further ahead. Veron was a superb footballer with immense stamina. I confess, I found working with Argentinian footballers quite difficult. There was a deep patriotism towards Argentina. They always had the flag round them. I had no problem with that, but the ones I managed didn't try particularly hard to speak English. With Veron, it was just Mister. But what a good footballer. His intelligence in the game and his engine were first rate. The problem? We couldn't find a position in which to play him. If we played him in the centre of midfield, he would end up at centre forward, or wide right, or wide left. He just hunted the ball. We found it increasingly hard to fit him, Scholes and Keane into a midfield. Although he played some terrific games for us, you couldn't see the shape of the team forming. You couldn't see the positional stability that you look for normally. Beckham had left us, Ryan was getting older, as were Roy and Paul, and we were looking for that freshness to give us the impetus to evolve a bit. Although there were spectacular contributions, Veron just couldn't play in our team. He was an individual. He was the sort who, if you played red versus yellow on the training ground, would play for both teams. He just played everywhere. He went wherever he liked. If I managed him for 100 years, I wouldn't know where to play him. He was the wild card, the joker. Somebody once said to me, "Have you ever thought of playing him in a sitting position, holding in front of the two centre-backs?" I replied, "Are you dreaming? I can't get him to stay in any other position. Why would he stay in that one?" Apparently he'd played there for Lazio and been magnificent. But he was a free bird, flying everywhere. There were moments when he would take you to the heavens. In one pre-season game, he beat a couple of men on the byline and knocked it in for Van Nistelrooy to score. He hit a pass for Beckham with the outside of his foot and no backlift, and it bent away round the defence. Beckham ran onto it and lobbed the goalkeeper. In moments, he could be sublime. Talent-wise, there was absolutely nothing wrong with him. He had 2 fine feet. He could run. His control was magnificent. His vision was brilliant. He just couldn't fit into the team. The English game was not a barrier to him. He was brave. He always had the balls to play. There was talk during his time with us of Veron falling out with other players, but I don't think he did, partly because he never spoke to anyone. He was alone in the dressing room. He didn't speak the language. He wasn't antisocial. He just wasn't a communicator. I'd come in for work. "Morning, Seba." "Morning, mister." And that was it. You couldn't drag anything from him. I do remember a fallout with Roy Keane after a European tie. That became a bit ugly. But no, he was not a disruptive influence. We were trying to alter the way we played in Europe. 2 years after the 1999 European Cup win, we went to play Anderlecht in Belgium and PSV in Eindhoven. And we were battered. Only in the counter-attack. We played the traditional United way, 4-4-2, and were thumped. I told the players and staff that if we could not keep the ball better and stay solid in midfield, we were going to suffer more that way because opponents had sussed us out. So we switched to playing 3 in the centre of the park. Veron was part of that development. Managing change, which I had to do so often over that decade, I came up against many players I admired. I tried so hard, for example, to get Paolo Di Canio. The deal was all done. We had made an offer that he had accepted. But then he came back saying he wanted more. We couldn't agree to the new demand. But he was the sort of player Manchester United should have. One who could put bums on seats and get people off them too. I had players like that for the whole time I was there. Then there was Ronaldinho, another who slipped the hook. I agreed a deal to bring him to Old Trafford. Carlos was there and would vouch for that. The attempt to buy Ronaldinho reflected the fact that United have always sported talismanic players. I was always hunting for that kind of talent. My line of reasoning was, we're getting £25 million for Beckham and we're getting Ronaldinho for £19 million. For God's sake, wake up! It was a steal! On the way home from our trip to America, we stopped in Newfoundland to refuel at a tiny outpost. Only a single hut marked the landscape. As we waited for the refueling, the cabin crew opened the door to let fresh air in, and a small boy was standing at the fence, alone, with a United flag. We weren't allowed to disembark. We could stand in the steps, but not the tarmac. So all we could do was wave to this little United fan, pressed against a fence in the middle of nowhere. Returning to Europe for a stop in Portugal, we sold Veron, who had told Quinton Fortune he would be joining Chelsea. I wouldn't let him go for less than £15 million. Chelsea offered £9 million. I said, no way is he going for £9 million. But in Portugal, Kenyon told me, I've agreed the deal, £15 million. Then came the game against Sporting Lisbon and Ronaldo versus John O'Shea. I can still hear myself shouting at John, get close to him, Sheezy! I can't, came the plaintive reply. 1 month later, David Gill rang and said,
what about this? Kenyon is off to Chelsea.
David took over and was fantastic. A big improvement. Peter Kenyon, I felt, tried to take on too much and was consequently unable to deliver on some of the most important tasks. The expertise you need in a chief executive role is a talent for completing missions. When David Gill moved into the hot seat, I suspect he was uncertain about his function. David was an accountant by trade. My advice was, on the back of Peter Kenyon, don't take on too much. Delegate. Without doubt, he was the best administrator or chief executive I ever dealt with. First class, straight as a die. Very approachable. Kept his feet on the ground and knew the value of the game. Understood it too. Martin Edwards also had a good knowledge of the game, but there were no complications with David. He might tell you something you didn't like, but he would not shirk from saying it. That was the only way to be. Although Martin supported me at the most important times, I was always underpaid until David took charge. There is no substitute for being appreciated at work. To be told you are doing a fine job is all very well, as far as it goes, but there has to be monetary recognition. Dealing with changes in ownership is immensely difficult for club directors. After a takeover, the whole picture changes. Do they fancy you? Do they want a new manager, a new chief executive? The Glazer buy-up was the toughest period for David. The media focus was intense. The debt issue was never out of the news, but David's accountancy qualifications gave him an advantage in that respect. My vision of the club was as a place where young talent could develop. To sustain that aim, we needed to preserve the foundation of Giggs, Scholes and Neville and Roy Keane. We had enough backbone to enable us to shop around for potential. Van der Sar was another foundation player. He was one of my best ever signings. The search for the new Brian Robson had led us to Keane. Eric Jemba Jemba struck us as potentially another top central midfielder. I went to see him playing in France and he did really well. He understood the game, nipped attacks in the bud very well and was available for €4 million. I was at that game to see the Rennes goalkeeper too, Petracek, who was 18 or 19. I told myself he was too young for us. Sometimes you lost one player but gained another of similar merit. We missed out on Paul Gascoigne, for example, but landed Paul Ince. We didn't persuade Alan Shearer to join us, but we did sign Eric Cantona. The balls are always in the air. You have a range of targets and compensate from the list when one gets away. The unifying aim was to develop whichever player we ended up with. Cantona was in his mid-twenties, but our normal target area would be younger than that. Rooney and Ronaldo came as teenagers. After 2006 or so, we redoubled our efforts to avoid falling into the old trap of seeing a team grow old together. We refocused on that. With Andy Cole, Dwight York and Teddy Sheringham, there was either a falling off in performance levels or an advance in years. In those circumstances, the demands on the scouting network intensify. The heat is on the talent spotters. You're saying to them all the time, come on, what have you seen out there? The Cleberson signing came after he had excelled for Brazil in the 2002 World Cup. He was still playing in his homeland when we signed him. But he was an example of the risks associated with making a purchase in a hurry. What we were looking for was someone to take over eventually from Keane, which is how Vieira had entered the picture. He would have been ideal. He was used to the English game, an imposing figure, a leader. One sign of a great player is that the opposing fans sing songs against him. Opposing fans always sang songs against Patrick Vieira. That tells you they feared them. Alan Shearer was another, always on the wrong end of chants from the opposition. Cleberson was a talented player, but he exemplifies my point about careful examination of background and character. We acquired him too easily. It made me uncomfortable. When the boy arrived, we discovered he had married a 16-year-old girl. He was 23. She brought all her family over. In pre-season training in Portugal, at Valdelobo, only the players were meant to come to breakfast before training. Cleberson brought his father-in-law. He seemed to have no authority in that area. Lovely lad, but he lacked the confidence to learn English. In games, he displayed terrific stamina and a high degree of skill, but was unable to impose his personality. Perhaps the way Brazil had used him was not the way we wanted to employ him. With his country, he sat in front of the back four to help Roberto Carlos and Cafu bomb on from fullback. When there is a sudden rush to solve problems, mistakes are made. We were at our best when we worked from a plan over years and studied players, compiled detailed information. We knew all about Cristiano Ronaldo before we signed him. We tried to get Rooney at 14 and tried again at 16. Finally, we cracked it when he was 17. You could plan for Rooney. He was an obvious target for us. That was Manchester United scouting at its very best. The Varones and Clebersons were improvised, not panic-buys, but rushed. Jemba Jemba, another smashing lad, was hammered by the press for not being a signature signing. They always liked the marquee names and took a much dimmer view of players with a lower recognition rating. They loved Varone at first. They were lukewarm about Clebersen and Jemba Jemba. David Bellion was young, and we felt we could develop him. He was lightning quick, a charming boy, a Christian, but also very shy. He had been at Sunderland and had come on as a sub against us, tore us apart. We made a move for him when his contract was up. Had we looked into his background more, we'd have known he was diffident. We sold him to Nice for €1 million, and he moved from there to Bordeaux, which brought us an additional fee. The Bellion transfer was not one you could classify as an attempt to lay a foundation stone for a new side. He was an add-on who was available at a good price. The turning point in this whole chapter was capturing Ronaldo and Rooney, which gave us the signature signings we needed. Talismanic, match-winning players, in line with our tradition. Patrice Evra and Nemanja Vidic in January 2006 were to be other stellar acquisitions. The first point in our notes on Vidic was his courage, his determination. He could tackle, head the ball clear. We were looking at a typical English centre-back. Vida hadn't played since the end of the season in Moscow, in November. In his first game for us against Blackburn, he was breathing out of his backside. He needed a pre-season, that was the gist of it. At left-back, in Dennis Irwin's old position, we had Heinze, briefly, but then moved on to Evra, who was used as a wing-back at Monaco, where he featured in the Champions League final against Porto. With full-backs, it's like searching for a rare bird. When we first saw Evra, he was playing as a wing-back, but he had the speed and was young enough to switch to full-back in our system. We knew plenty about his attacking capabilities. He was quick, had superb technique, and a strong personality. Very strong. Heinze was another matter. Ruthless, would kick his granny. But an absolute winner who could also play centre-back. In both cases, we were successful. As all United fans will remember, Evra's debut came in the Manchester derby at Eastlands and was a total disaster. You could see him thinking, why am I here? Eventually, he settled and developed. Heinze, on the other hand, had a mercenary streak, and I always had the sense he was scanning the horizon for his next deal. After 1 year, he wanted to leave. We were playing Villarreal and stationed in a lovely complex outside Valencia when his agent came to see me to say he wanted to move. Things were never the same after that. The following day, he injured his cruciate. We did everything possible to accommodate him. He was allowed to pursue his rehabilitation in Spain. He was there for 6 months and came back for a single game. We did our best. But at the end of December, he came back wanting away, wanting new terms, a new contract. When he returned fully from injury, he went to see David Gill with his agent, and we agreed we would be better off without him. We agreed to let him go for €9 million. They went straight to Liverpool, who said they would take him. Gabriel was told, with no ambiguity, that historically Manchester United do not sell players to Liverpool, and vice versa. Heinze's advisers then tried to make a legal issue of it, which led to a meeting in London in which the Premier League sided with us. During that process, the chairman of Crystal Palace contacted David Gill to say someone representing Heinze had asked them to buy him so they could later sell him on to Liverpool. We used that information as part of our evidence. The judgment came down in our favour, and eventually we offloaded him to Real Madrid. These guys move around. Heinze had been at two Spanish clubs already before he went to PSG, from where he came to us. Alan Smith was another addition from that time, in May 2004, for €7 million. Leeds were in financial trouble by then, and word came through to David Gill that Alan could be bought for around €5 million. I had always liked Alan. He was what I called an attitude player, with a good character. He could play a few positions, wide right, midfield, centre-forward. He was a Mark Hughes-type player, not a great goal scorer, but useful to the team. We later sold him to Newcastle for £6 million. Alan did a fair job for us and put in some smashing performances. His leg break at Liverpool in 2006 was one of the most horrific I've seen. I'll always remember rushing to see him as he lay in the Liverpool treatment table. Liverpool's doctor was exemplary, I should say. Well, they injected him to stop the onset of trauma. His foot was pointing in all sorts of directions. Bobby Charlton, who was with me, winced, and he had been through the Munich air disaster. Alan, on the other hand, was unperturbed. He was sitting there, emotionless. It was a horror of an accident. Alan's reaction told me that some men's pain thresholds are higher than others. Jabs terrify me. I'm hopeless with needles. In my pub-keeping days in Glasgow, during a keg change one Sunday morning, I was releasing a spear to let the air out when a rat jumped on my shoulder. I let back, and the spear of the keg sank into my cheek. You can still see the skin graft. I drove the 2 miles to the hospital afraid to touch it. The nurse whipped it out, and I fainted as soon as they put the needle in me. The nurse said, "This is the big centre forward of Rangers Football Club, and he's fainting." I was dying there. Alan was sitting with one of the worst injuries I have ever seen, and not a bit of stir in him. That's what Alan was, a supremely brave lad. He was a good, honest professional too. What he lacked was the real top quality you need to excel at the biggest clubs. When we were offered the money by Newcastle, we had to let him go. Our final use of him was as a defensive midfielder. He tackled well, but didn't read the game like an authentic holding player. He was a midfield player who could tackle whatever the ball was. In his centre-forward days, centre-backs seldom had an easy time with Alan. But the whole process of replacing Roy required us to find a player who could sit in good areas of the pitch, the way Owen Hargreaves did for a while. Alan wasn't that type, but he was a good, honest player who loved playing for us. It took me a long time to persuade him that I couldn't guarantee him a game. The team had moved on. Louis Saha was another major signing from Fulham in January 2004, but persistent injuries counted against him and us. We watched him a couple of times at Metz, but the scouting reports gave no indication that he would be a target for the biggest clubs. He turned up at Fulham, and every time he played against us, he gave us a doing. In an FA Cup tie at Craven Cottage, he turned Wes Brown on the halfway line, flew at a goal, cut it back, and Fulham scored. From then on, we watched him all the time, and by January, we were ready to make our move. Dealing with Mohamed Fayed, Fulham's owner, was a complicated process. Word came back that a figure had been agreed, and we were told, "This is the best you're going to get." It was a middle position, 12 million. Of all the centre-forwards we employed, when you talk about their talents, two-footed, good in the air, spring, speed, power, Saha would be one of the best. He posed a perpetual threat, but then came the injuries. Louis, who lived about 50 yards from me, was a lovely lad. Had to be 150% to play. It was agony for us. And it wasn't a case of him being out for weeks, it tended to be months. The reason for selling him was that no matter how talented he was, I could never plan around him, could never say, "This is my team for the next 2 or 3 years." Saha was young enough to be viewed in that way, as a cornerstone player, but the uncertainty caused by his constant non-availability rendered it impossible to look far down the line. It became so vexing to him that he considered retiring. "You're a young man. You don't give in because of an injury. You've just got to work to get back. This can't last forever," I told him. He was assailed by guilt. He thought he was letting us down. He would send me apologetic texts to that effect. I tried to impress on him that he had been unlucky and that unlucky players could be found throughout footballing history. Viv Anderson was one. When we were assessing Viv's playing record at Arsenal, we noticed that in 4 years he missed 4 games, suspension every time. Viv came to us and was never fit. We gave him a free transfer to Sheffield Wednesday, and he played there for 3 years and hardly missed a game. I used to give him stick about that. I'd say, "I don't think you wanted to play for me." He's a big United fan and was desperate to shine for us, but was halted by persistent knee trouble. Louis knew his injuries were hampering his form, and that's where the guilt complex began biting away at him. Carlos devised a 2-week programme for him to enable him to be fully ready in a fortnight. This was tailored work, which he did on his own. We explained that to him, and he embraced it, shooting, turning, and generally throwing himself into these preparatory exercises. It was flying. Friday, the day before the game, and Saha walks off, saying he had felt something in his hamstring. We were never going to conquer that physical sensitivity. So we reached a deal with Everton in 2008. Everton copied our approach and tried to raise Louis to a level where he would be confident of playing. It might have helped him to be away from the pressure of Manchester United. He was a fantastic centre-forward, though. In the 2009-2010 season, I thought France would be mad not to take him to the World Cup. A constant in our discussions about young players, in terms of whether they could handle the demands of the Old Trafford crowd and the short patience span of the media, was temperament. Would they grow or shrink in a United shirt? We knew the make-up of every young homegrown player who came into the United starting 11, from the training ground, from reserve team football. You can't leave your character in the dressing room. It has to come out of that room, down the tunnel and onto that pitch. In the 2003-2004 season, we finished third in the league behind the Invincibles of Arsenal, but finished off with a 3-0 win over Millwall in the FA Cup final in Cardiff. Ronaldo was majestic in that match, scoring our first goal with a header before Van Nistelrooy added two more, one from the penalty spot. The year had been overshadowed by the death of Jimmy Davis in a road accident. Jimmy, 21, was one of those bright, breezy individuals. He had a chance too. He would have had a career in the game. We had loaned him to Watford. On the way to an academy game at our place that Saturday morning, I heard that Watford's game that afternoon had been postponed. There were no details given. Then I was told, at the academy game, of Jimmy's death in a road accident. He was a tenacious wee lad. Very popular. A large number from the club attended his funeral. 2 years later, at a wedding, I felt a creeping sense of déjà vu. As the photographs were being taken outside, the minister came over to me and said, "Would you like to come round and see Jimmy's grave?" I hadn't made the connection, and it chilled me to the core. It was so sad. He would not be forgotten by Manchester United. 8. Ronaldo. Cristiano Ronaldo was the most gifted player I managed. He surpassed all the other great ones I coached at United, and I had many. The only ones who could be placed near him would be a couple of the home-produced players, Paul Scholes and Ryan Giggs, because they contributed so prodigiously to Manchester United for 2 decades. That longevity, consistency and those behaviour patterns were quite exceptional. We lost our wizard, Cristiano, to Real Madrid in the end, but we looked back at his time with us with pride and gratitude. In 6 seasons with us, from 2003 to 2009, he scored 118 times in 292 games and won the Champions League, 3 Premier League titles, 1 FA Cup and 2 League Cups. He scored in the 2008 Champions League final against Chelsea in Moscow and kicked a ball for us for the final time 12 months later in the final against Barcelona in Rome. In between, we watched a special talent bloom in our training pitches at Carrington and in our first 11, which passed through a lean spell in the middle years of the decade. We helped Ronaldo to be the player he was, and he helped us recapture the excitement and self-expression of Manchester United teams. Madrid paid $80 million in cash for him, and do you know why? It was a way for Florentino Perez, their president, to say to the world, "We are Real Madrid. We are the biggest of the lot." It was a clever move by them, and a declaration of their intent to chase the game's most famous players. Ramon Calderon, Perez's predecessor, had claimed the previous year that Cristiano would one day be a Real Madrid player. I knew full well that if they produced the $80 million, he would have to go. We could not block his fervent wish to return to Iberia and wear the famous white shirt of Di Stefano or Zidane. The reality of managing Ronaldo, as of other talents who came to Manchester United as teenagers, was that you could oversee the early years fairly comfortably, because they were not yet global idols. They were on the way up. At the point they became megastars, as Ronaldo did, you asked yourself a question that Carlos Queiroz and I discussed all the time. How long are we going to be able to keep Cristiano Ronaldo?